The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Drug addiction continues to be a problem in this country and other parts of the world. The amazing fact is that you may not know that you're living with an addiction problem and that the drugs in question may be in your own home. This is Afflicted by Addiction with your host, Bradley DeHaven. Brad has been on the front lines of addiction and will share the wisdom he's discovered along with guest experts and those who have lived through it or are living through it right now. Here's your host, Bradley DeHaven.
Welcome to Afflicted by Addiction. I'm Bradley DeHaven. I'm your host. I'm here every Tuesday at noon, and you can also listen to our show after the fact at rxdrugaddict.com. Once it airs, it's there for you to listen to at your convenience. Today we have a great show, and I'm not going to spend much time on the intro because I have the valuable time of Senator DeSaunier, and he's here with me today. Welcome, Senator.
Thanks, Bradley. Happy to be here.
Well, great to have you here. We're going to kind of dive in at some point into the Cures Bill and educate our audience as to what that's all about. But I always start off my show with the same question because I find that the answer is so different for everybody. And I'm going to ask you that question. And Senator, are you afflicted by addiction?
Well, I'd be surprised if any American answered that response with a no. My dad was a judge in Massachusetts. He was a legislator, and he was an alcoholic. He ended up losing his job, his pension. He was the first, went and got a master's degree a long time ago before this was popular. And substance abuse, he was the first drug addiction counselor for a National Football League team, geez, 25, 30 years ago. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to keep his sobriety, and he took his life. So obviously that's had an effect on me. And professionally, it's hard not to know people, and both professionally and personally, who don't struggle with addiction.
Right. You know, I've met you before, one case in particular, at a showing of the movie Behind the Orange Curtain. Mm-hmm. And I've interviewed on this show both the producer and the director of Behind the Orange Curtain. And as you may or may not remember, myself and my son are actually in that movie, along with a lot of people that were there that day doing a Q&A afterwards. How does an event like that, where you get to see the belly of the beast and how addiction has afflicted all of these people just face-to-face, hit you as a senator?
Oh, I think it's amazingly powerful. And it's a combination of statistics and, of course, the personal stories, the story you'll hear with April Rivera next, the story I've heard many times from Bob Pack, my personal story. I think, you know, as admonition is in recovery, the acceptance that we have a problem is the first step. And I think as a culture, we have a serious problem that way. But events like that start to remove the stigma, allow Americans to understand that behavioral health is a condition of the human experience. And the sooner we accept that and accept that there are ways to deal with it more successfully than we have in the past, that's a huge accomplishment. So every one of these stories takes another step towards making America get out of its stigma problems when it comes to individuals with behavioral health problems, substance abuse problems, and mental health challenges.
You know, you touch on stigma, Senator, and one of the things that I notice, I've talked to literally over several thousand, either of those parents, family members, loved ones, addicts themselves, and one of the things that I don't know about any of those people that I've talked to, and I know they're deepest, darkest secrets. I don't know if a single one of them is a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent, or a communist. So to me, this is one of the very rare issues that shouldn't have party lines. What do you think?
No, it should not. And particularly with what we're learning on the research and how the brain works with emotions and chemical dependency, depression, and how all that interacts. When you think of how much progress we're making from a research standpoint, this is a part of the human condition, and we should approach it that way. The worst thing we can do, in my view, and the thing that actually makes me hard not to get angry about is the stigma problem. And I go back to my personal experience. I was the last person to talk to my dad. I didn't know he was in the trouble he was. I didn't know he'd start drinking and popping pills again. And I, you know, 20 years later, I still think if he hadn't felt the shame, he might still be with us.
So many people share those exact feelings about their loved ones. They wonder what they could have done differently. They roll back that time clock, and they beat themselves up a lot sometimes about what they could have done differently. But in the end, it's one of those things that happens. And I think I am so humbled by the people like April Rivero, who's coming up next, who shares her story to help others never walk her dark path.
Well, that's the inspirational part. So you can get frustrated and angry with the lack of evolution by our species in this regard, but then you look at people like April or Bob Pack or yourself, and the courage to come out and say, we're not going to be ashamed about what happened to our loved ones. We're going to have the courage to admit that this is our story. We're going to tell it. And the amazing thing for me, and I'm sure that's for you too, and you sort of intimated this, when you tell it, there's sort of a breakthrough where I remember years ago there was a very large profile of me in the local newspaper here in the East Bay. And my political consultant was quite concerned because they had done background work in the Boston Globe about my dad's past and his suicide and his substance abuse. And she was afraid that that's all that voters would remember was my name and something negative. And I found just the opposite, that everybody has a story similar. It may not be as dramatic, it may be more dramatic, but there's an acceptance there that ultimately is where I think this our culture will change. And then we'll start using the research that we're learning about, the compassion that you hear in your story and mine and others, to actually start to help people. And we're doing that now, but we should be much further along than we've come.
You're right. You know, I've written two books on the subject of addiction, and my second title, I'm not pitching my book, but I just want, it relates to what you just said. My second title was the easiest thing I ever did, was title that book. And I titled it after speaking and joining all these people and standing on stage with all these people that we've talked about. I titled it The Addict Among Us. Because
yeah,
to me, I couldn't go anywhere that wasn't the case.
Right.
So,
it's just so important. It seems so obvious to all of us. But, you know, you and, as I say, everyone who tells their story takes another step closer to acceptance, and I think a real point where our culture will change dramatically. And it's not that behavioral health is accepted in the sense that we just go, well, you know, people commit suicide, people get addicted. It's quite the opposite. We accept that it's a reality in human existence, but there are things that we are learning and that we can, in our own way, at that point, become less acceptable to just tolerating it and implement changes that will save people's lives and let them live full and happy lives.
And reform is such an important part of what we parents who are afflicted by addiction, or even those whose children passed with one dosage from a prescribed medication that their own doctor gave their child. I mean, it's just, there's so many stories. But reform is something that a lot of people resist, too. And that's where we do get into whether it's the party lines or just people's personal, you know, ignorance of not knowing what's going on out here, that people, it's kind of like cars. At one time in the past, cars only did 5 miles an hour. There wasn't really a need for seatbelts. But now cars do 150, 200 miles an hour, and lives have been saved. There's no cure-all. People still die in car accidents. But don't you see prescription drugs as having evolved to where they now do 200 miles an hour?
Well, exactly. And there's this whole debate in American politics since Hamilton and Jefferson about the difference between individual merit and the free marketplace and the importance of the commonwealth and the social contract. So what's frustrating in the political realm and when it comes to prescription drugs, there are people who make a lot of money legally over the fact that prescription drugs are overprescribed and abused, and they have been reluctant to honestly and openly accept their responsibility. And I'm talking specifically about the pharmaceutical industry, to a certain degree the medical industry. You know, it's just so ironic. One of the most unbelievable statistics, and I may have learned it that day at the screening, was 80% of the opiates in the world are used by Americans, but we constitute 6% of the world's population.
Exactly.
Well, as a politician, I know part of the reason for that is that there are entrenched powers who contribute significant campaign contributions and intimidate us politicians into not doing what's best for everybody.
I agree. And when you see that as a parent and as a person who's an advocate and talks to people who utter the words they never thought they'd say, and that's my child, the heroin addict, or utter the words that are even worse than that, and that their child has passed. It really, it hurts you to think that these people, that there's any money involved in this, but we do know there's so much money involved from the pharmaceutical level on up.
Well, we as human beings can rationalize quite a lot, and we're all guilty of it to a degree. But there's clearly a problem, in my view, in this country right now about the marketplace and basically sanitized corruption. And this country's got to come to grips with that. And this is one of those instances where it's particularly acute. We can see other models in my time in politics and in my other professional career as a restaurant owner and as somebody who has had multiple liquor licenses. I saw Mothers Against Drunk Driving change drunk driving laws. I know people in the restaurant business fought that. But at some point, a lot of us said, you know, we don't want to get people drunk and make an extra $1,000 over somebody's misery. Tobacco industry, probably more acutely. They still do it. We know that tobacco is addictive. It has really no positive good, in my view, either physically, but there's money to be made. So but in both of those instances are examples of the public actually taking control of the debate and having a very large influence.
And mitigation on behalf of the people that make those products, as opposed to Big Pharma.
And all those costs are transferred to people. I mean, people will talk about the beauty of the marketplace, which I agree with, but there's got to be a framework. It's from Economics 101 and rent taking. If the cost is transferred to the general public, then as a former business owner, I don't think that's fair.
Senator DeSaunier, this is going to air on August the 13th. That's a day, last I heard, that you're going to be talking about a bill, the Cures Bill, is that correct?
Uh-huh.
And can you tell our listeners, what is the Cures Bill and what does it mean for Californians?
Well, it was brought to me by a constituent who lost his two children on a Sunday afternoon when they went out for a walk in a very well-to-do part of the Bay Area, Danville, California, Bob Pack. He brought the idea, he's a software engineer, of bringing the prescription drug monitoring system in California into the 21st century. So the idea is to have real-time information for every prescriber and then have the Department of Justice oversee it. We have not had the financial capacity to get the 200,000 prescribers plus in California on that system. If we are able to pass this bill and get it signed by the governor, we will be able to. So California was once one of the leaders in the United States in having a prescription drug monitoring system and having the Cures system. We almost last year joined Missouri as the only state without any prescription drug monitoring system. With this bill, we'll have enough to upgrade the system over the next 2 years, get every prescriber in it, is my hope, and be able to have the Department of Justice and the users of the system access so that we can cover those big gaps where people are doctor shopping, abusive doctors are not being responsible, and organized crime is finding ways to crack the hole as well. So all of those things will get us a long way to start to see the trend of prescription drug abuse to change from one of growth to one of significant decrease.
So the Cures program essentially lacks funding is one of the biggest obstacles. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, it's correct, and it's frustrating. We have a general fund budget this year in California of a little over $96 billion. We could get this program all fully ramped up, including the aspects of it that I've not been no longer exist in the bill enforcement teams, up for $15 million a year. That would bring us a real Cadillac system. Not very much in the scheme of a $96 billion budget.
Well, putting the human aspect of this aside, which is difficult to do, but since it is all about money at some given point, have there been studies done on what this would save Californians in cost of medical care and overdoses and visits to the emergency room and things like that, or is that just too daunting to nail down?
No, there have been. Workers' compensation, which we know has serious problems, obviously, and so they've done a study, just the company, the Workers' Compensation Corp. company in California, and says that costs over-prescribing and prescription drug abuse costs them $50 million a year. Kaiser, I believe, has done studies, closed system like Kaiser, which Bob Pack was part of, his family, as I understand it, they have serious desires to control costs. So there's a huge financial consequence, much bigger than $50 million, when you look at the indirect cost as well, the loss of life, the loss of wages and earnings for those individuals. I mean, when you get to that point, it's in the hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion.
And you've got prescription drugs that are addicting these people and driving them to drugs like even heroin, because these prescription drugs are basically a replica of heroin in a shiny tablet. And you've got prescription drugs out here driving this kind of addiction, death. You've got parents out here that are paying to send their children to rehab, paying to bury their own children, and paying for the drugs to get them off of the drugs that were paid for them to get on through their insurance. It's ludicrous.
That's really crazy. That the other side of the coin is, which I have a bill on as well, and have tried before, is oversight for people who provide substance abuse counseling, where there's not enough oversight. We don't even require background checks in California for people who do personal. If you go through a state or county agency, they're required background checks. But I have constituents who have sent their kids to counseling, and the counselors have still been abusing. So we've got a huge problem when it comes to substance abuse, and prescription drug is a significant part of it, both in terms of interdicting where the supply goes and then with treating people when they have a problem. It's just wasteful in so many ways.
Absolutely. A few weeks ago, I interviewed a young man who went by the name of Brian, an admitted drug dealer and an addict in recovery, who I specifically asked him and described the Cures program to him, and I asked him what he thought that would have done to his business of buying and selling and filling prescriptions and, you know, this lifestyle that he had when he was a dealer. And he said it would shut it down, that there wouldn't be the supply to satisfy the demand, that people would stop becoming addicted, like himself, who's now in recovery because it eventually gets everybody in its way. But here's a drug dealer describing to me how the Cures system would have kept him from being a drug dealer.
Yeah, that's an amazing statement. And I think the reason we haven't been able to find the funding for it is twofold. One is denial by a lot of people that there is a problem. It's painful, which goes back to the stigma and the shame and the courage of we as a culture to accept it through the actions of individuals like yourself. But the second part is more troubling, that there are people who make money by this, and it's sanitized corruption, in my view.
I totally agree.
Of the worst kind.
You know, the doctors have been somewhat reluctant to embrace cures. You hear a variety of excuses, for lack of a better term, or reasons why they think cures would be bad for them. What are some of the reasons that you hear from the doctors?
There's some legitimate ones. For example, I think legitimate ones, emergency room doctors who are dealing in trauma units. We've tried to accommodate them. The other side that I have more problem with is, doctors are brought up in a culture. They go to graduate school. A lot of them are the best and brightest amongst us. And they're led to believe that what they're doing is amongst the finest healing in the world. And in lots of instances, that's true. But in lots of instances, that's unfortunately not true. So if you've got a culture where everybody thinks that everybody who puts a smock on and is a doctor somehow knows best, that's just not reality, and there has to be some discipline within the culture. So, and some of it is just coming up. I think some of it is demographics and generational. People who are my age, I'm in my 60s, who are doctors, aren't used to using technology. They're used to doing it a different way, paper-wise. So some of that is just a cultural problem. So not to ascribe evilness to all of this, some of it is just a reluctance to change.
Well, you know, I'll give you this, and I think everybody admits or would be willing to admit that the dirty doctors are the exception, not the rule.
Mm-hmm.
But on that note, I would think that the doctors that aren't dirty would want a system like this in place to expose those people who are giving the name doctor, in my opinion, a bad name, for doing exactly what they're doing, and that's overprescribing and prescribing for profit or legalized drug dealing, like so many that we've seen arrested, including April Rivero, who'll be joining us, the doctor that prescribed her son deadly drugs.
No, and I've heard that over and over again at the event you mentioned that you and I both spoke of, that April helped coordinate in Concord for the movie. We heard in the question and answer period, and I've heard it multiple times from the people who I think, unfortunately for America, the vast majority of doctors and prescribers, they feel just as you said, that this is a very significant responsibility. And as people who have committed their lives to first do no harm, they want to make sure that they don't overprescribe, and they want to make sure that their profession is not tainted with people who do overprescribe.
Absolutely. You know, doctors also say that, and I've interviewed a lot of doctors, but doctors also say that they feel basically an obligation or a pressure to prescribe. And to me, and how about you, don't you think that the Cures program would give them data that might give these doctors a documentable reason not to prescribe a pain pill or something to somebody, to a possible addict?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And, you know, part of this discussion, to be fair to the medical profession as well, is we have to have a constant, really well-thought-out research and ongoing discussion about the proper prescriptions to every individual. So that's part of our frustration, I think, at least mine in the legislature, when I look at the medical board. I don't think they've been aggressive enough about knowing, because you don't want to underprescribe either for people who are in great pain. You want to make sure they have the right dosage. So there's an argument, there's a really good discussion there to have about the proper prescriptions and making sure that people aren't underprescribed as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, let's talk about the journey of Cures a little bit. It wasn't too long ago that you had a vote and Cures was stricken down, and now it's back again and a little bit different. Will you share with our audience what happened there and how it came back?
I think if memory serves me now, I'm up to my fifth or sixth time trying to run this bill since I've been in the legislature. I have, and previously it didn't get out of its first policy committee. I couldn't get enough Democratic votes for it. Whenever I attached a fee to the pharmaceutical industry, that they were strong enough to kill it in the first policy committee. So we were actually, the reason we have been able to get it as far as we have, and we couldn't have got it off the Senate floor without removing the part of the bill that we heretofore had in it that required a fee on the pharmaceutical industry. The other big benefit has been the fact that people are becoming more aware, and specifically the Los Angeles Times have expended quite a bit of resources in having two full-time reporters do extensive stories on it. So it's had a very big impact in the second largest media market in the United States, and it's had an impact, obviously, on the representatives from that area.
Well, the reporting from the LA Times has been incredible. Their job on tracking this down has been unprecedented, don't you think?
Oh, yes. And it's a perfect example of democracy can't work if you don't have that kind of efforts in the media. That had a direct impact on my ability to get extra votes to get it to the point that it's gone to this point.
So the primary things that were removed were basically the financial support from Big Pharma, because
Right. They
bowed up and did their work to squash it when they were having to pay for it. I honestly don't think it was much that you guys were asking for. I think they were probably more worried about the drop in sales that would have happened, at least, you know, in my particular opinion. I'm not putting words in your mouth. But then the other side of it was the mandatory use of Cures, correct?
It was. So for what it was going to cost them on this iteration, it was about $5 million a year, and that would have funded the enforcement teams that the Department of Justice and the Attorney General, and by the way, Kamala Harris, our Attorney General here in California, has been a great partner. She's been really a big help on this and very committed to it. So they were very resistant to having us do that. You know, this is in a state where opiate sales are in the hundreds of millions of dollars, so $5 million. And I had many conversations with them, with their lobbyists, and with some of their representatives, the company's lobbyists, in-house lobbyists, about, you know, it's in your best interest to contribute to this as well.
Right. I agree, but it seems that they continue to buck it. But now that it's in its new form, because the goal here is, let's just call it baby steps, to get in the door and get this thing up and running and get it funded enough, and additional changes, I believe, could be made down the road as it's embraced, don't you think?
Oh, that's my hope. So for the enforcement teams, although that was a hard thing for me to take out and frustrating, where it's going to take us a couple of years in the Department of Justice to get the system up. So I'm not going away. I still have 3.5 years left in the Senate. I'm going to stay at it and get the funding for enforcement, because ultimately you can have all this information, and if you don't have enforcement, it's not going to be effective.
Right. So what's next for the Cures Bill? It's August 13th, the day that this will air. Do you feel like the Cures Bill will pass?
I'm pretty confident. I believe we had got 30 out of 38 senators available. We received 36 votes. So we get a lot of Republican support once we took the fee out. I'm hopeful the same thing will happen in the Assembly.
Well, I'm hopeful as well, and I want you to know I'm very optimistic about Cures, even though with all of the things coming out, of course, there's disappointment there. I know there is with you. My pet name for it, I'll share with you, became Cures Light. So it was, to me, a couple of those provisions removed, but to me, I also see the future in that if we can get this thing in the door, we can work on increasing its, sharpening its teeth later, don't you think?
I do, Bradley, and I feel the same way as you. I've been a politician a long time. The ultimate goal is to save people's lives and start to reduce the suffering when it comes to prescription drug abuse, and this will go a significant way in that regard. So, as I said, I'm not going away. I know people like you and April and Bob Pack aren't. So we're going to get this signed. I'm reasonably confident, although you never know until the governor puts their signature on it and it gets through the legislative process, and then we're going to come back next year and do what we need to make sure that it continues to get stronger and stronger.
What do you believe? Cures Bill passes, let's say, and what do you believe is the next things that need to go into place to help, steps to curb prescription drug abuse?
Well, as I said, the first thing is we've got to find enforcement money. So the Department of Justice has to have that. We have to look at the medical review board. We have to make them much more accountable. And the problem with them heretofore, and April can speak to this as well, they have been an apologist, I think, for folks who aren't doing their job in the medical field, and they should be advocating for excellence, as we said before, on behalf of not just the clients, but for those doctors who believe in excellence when it comes to making sure that medical care is provided in a way that's best for the client. And then I think it's just shows like this and America. I think what we've done in the drug war in this country. Just got through reading a book, The New Jim Crow, by a Stanford law professor. When you look at the incarceration costs and the cost of the war on drugs in the United States of America and the pain and suffering, and this is illicit drugs, of course, but we have to have a whole new outlook on how we address addiction in the United States, which you and I all know about, most of your listeners know about, but it really has to be dramatic transformation of the way we approach behavioral health. And I think we're on the cusp of it, but the frustrating part, I feel, is there's not the sense of urgency in government that there should be, that the pain and suffering and the cost financially is way too great for this country.
I agree. Senator Desaigne, I appreciate your joining us today. A couple of final things I'd like to go over with you. One, what is everybody that I work with out here has some passion, whether it's worn on their sleeve or not. Describe your passion for this cause to me.
I'm sure it's related. I believe in behavioral health, obviously. I go and see a therapist who's helped me through things, and I'm not embarrassed by that. I've had my struggles in life. I've been fortunate. My relationship with my dad, I had one of my two sons had some issues that I'm fortunate. I'm knock on wood, he's been able to stay in recovery. It's just such a waste, and I guess the part of it that makes me angry and passionate about it is it's unnecessary, that if we were to come to grips with behavioral health, substance abuse, depression, that some of the waste and the stigma is just so frustrating, and we could so change the world.
So many people lose the stigma when they are afflicted by addiction or mental health problems of some sort, but a lot of people come in the door, and even those that I've interviewed, and will admit that they too looked at somebody who's addicted as a bad child or somebody who overdosed as a as a bad person. But once it hits and roosts at home, they understand that their beautiful little 18-year-old daughter or 20-year-old son or whoever never planned on becoming an addict. And sometimes, and in today's world, all the rules surrounding addiction have changed. And so many of our young addicts and our addicts in general, it's coming out of their medicine cabinet with a, you know, shiny little pills. So what do you suggest that we do as a society? Do you have any suggestions for people to get involved?
People should get involved, and whether it's listening to your show, I think April will speak to the efforts of groups that she's been involved with. I think that's really important, the critical mass, when you think about the illustrations I used on drunk driving. I mean, it was people getting organized. Tobacco, the successful tobacco efforts in California and across this country was because average citizens organized and got involved politically and in their communities. So this is really an important time, I think, politically in this country, that people can have to continue to realize that their voice can be heard in a meaningful way. But they've got to be emotional about it, they've got to be strategic about it, and they have to be, most importantly, in my view, is absolutely tenacious. They can't give up when they get frustrated. They have to just keep working at it.
Senator DeSaunier, I appreciate your time. We all appreciate your time and your passion to help those not walk in our paths and hopefully help people in the future, people that hopefully you'll never meet or talk to, but somehow your efforts will save their children. And we thank you so much for all the work that you do.
I appreciate it. Anytime. It's been a delight.
Well, I'm conscious of your schedule. I know that you've got another meeting to go to. Thank you so much for joining us today. You're listening to Afflicted by Addiction. I'm your host, Bradley DeHaven, and you can listen to this show later at rxdrugaddict.com. We'll be right back.
What's going on behind the scenes with your favorite Voice America show or host? For the latest news, visit the iRadio blog at iradioblog.com.
Hi, I'm Bradley DeHaven, and I'm the host of Afflicted by Addiction. The best rehab is the one that works for you. And this show has been made possible by the generous contribution of the rehab center that my son went to, Narcanon. I'm blessed that my son is 2.5 years clean of the drugs that once owned him. Narcanon gave him the tools that he needed to walk through a world filled with drugs and not return to the darkness of addiction. Narcanon did not want to run a commercial during this program, but I want to thank them for allowing the voice of those of you who are afflicted by addiction to be heard. Visit my website, rxdrugaddict.com, to get a link to Narcanon, and if you want to learn more, just click on the site. Again, the best rehab is the one that works for you. Most importantly, seek professional help if you are afflicted by addiction.
Prescription drug and heroin use are epidemic in America. Every 19 minutes, someone dies from a drug overdose. Every 24 minutes, someone dies from a prescription drug overdose. Where do these drugs come from? Your own medicine cabinet, the middle school playground, friends, and the biggest problem of all, dirty doctors. Behind the Orange Curtain is a hard-hitting documentary that will open your eyes and your heart to this very real epidemic facing our youth today. Prescription drugs and heroin use. Addiction crosses all socio and economic barriers. It doesn't matter if you live on Park Avenue or the park bench, no one is exempt. It's in your city, your county, your state, and in your backyard. Behind the Orange Curtain is coming to iTunes April 23rd. Check out Behind the Orange Curtain on Facebook and visit our website at www.behindtheorangecurtain.net.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
You are tuned in to Afflicted by Addiction with your host, Bradley DeHaven. If you have a question or comment for Brad about the program, please send an email to Brad at rxdrugaddict.com. That's Brad at rxdrugaddict.com. Now back to our program, Afflicted by Addiction.
Welcome back to Afflicted by Addiction. I'm your host, Bradley DeHaven. We were just joined by Senator DeSaunier out of the Bay Area of California, who has the ever-so-important Cures Bill, which is a prescription drug monitoring program for the state of California. We would be one of two states that didn't have a prescription drug monitoring program if Cures doesn't pass on this very day, the day of this airing, on August the 13th, 2013. It's sad to think that it's come to that. My next guest is April Rivero. April was my first guest ever when I started my radio show, so she has that, feather in her cap, or maybe I do. But April and I work closely together, and April has some firsthand experience with how she discovered that Cures data is really there, whether Cures is being used or not. Welcome to the show, April.
Thank you, Bradley. Appreciate being back again.
Well, you're my first repeat, so there's another bonus for you, too. I'm trying to get more feathers.
Yeah, I feel good about that. Okay, so, well, I love that.
But, you know, you've done so much for this, and, you know, I always ask people the same question. I'm going to ask you, even though I've asked you before, but I know we've talked about how the Cures Bill and everything, how you found out that Cures was kind of there in the shadows in a really unusual way. But tell our audience how you are afflicted by addiction. Tell them your story.
I think in the worst way, Bradley, you know my story, and it basically is that on December 18th, 2009, we got that call that no parent of a college student ever wants to get. And it was basically to let us know that out of 70,000 kids at that campus in Arizona where he was attending school, he was a student who wouldn't be coming home for winter break, at least not the way we expected. Joey had been found in his room that day, and ultimately we learned he had passed away from a combination of prescription meds that, you know, he mixed with alcohol in a typical party, you know, kind of college party setting, late the night before. And it took his life. We then also learned that a doctor down in Southern California had prescribed the medications that he took that night just 9 days before he died. And the tolerance he had to them obviously wasn't very high because it didn't take very much, just low levels of Xanax, moderate levels of oxycodone, and he was just over the legal limit for alcohol. So the combination, as happens all across the country every single day, shut down his breathing. He went to sleep that night, and he just didn't wake up. So that's about as afflicted as you can get. We lost our beautiful 21-year-old son, who was 5 months away from graduating from college from prescription meds.
Well, no one wants to feel that pain, but unfortunately, far too many people do. That what you just described is essentially lethal to so many people that we now know, correct?
Yeah, that's correct, and it doesn't take much, as is the case with in Joey's story. I have learned of parents who've lost a child to one single pill of OxyContin, or you know, just small amounts that you would never think would do harm, but they can. Everybody's body is different, and everybody reacts differently to any medication you take, and every single type of medication has a potential side effect that you have no idea until you take could affect you and lethally, as was the case with Joey. So
in Joey's case, he was going to Arizona State, correct?
Mm-hmm, he was, yes.
But how did he fill a prescription in Southern California, and why would he fill a prescription in Southern California?
Well, it was plain and simple, a dirty doctor, and I had never heard of that word or that term before this happened either. I heard about it the night he died. His girlfriend told me that a week before he died, he had gone to a dirty doctor in Southern California. So as the story unfolded, there were two young men that were fraternity, not fraternity brothers of his, but kids within that environment, fraternity kids in other fraternities. And one of those two had a relationship already established with this doctor in Southern California. He was from Southern California, and I've surmised, I don't know for sure, that he may have had a relationship with her before he even went off to college. But bottom line is, we were told after that he was basically taking people one by one from the college environment there at Arizona State to visit with this doctor. And for his time and effort and connection to this doctor, who was very well known for freely giving out meds to those who were looking for them, he would get half of the medications that were prescribed to whoever he brought that first visit.
And
then they
would
be off and running. Yeah, so every 30 days, then they could go back, all of them individually, and he'd bring his new culprits or, you know, his new people down to meet her, and they would be the next potential victims, as Joey was. So it was.
So what you're describing to me is a college road trip that they all jump in a car and then drove to Los Angeles. How far a drive?
Oh, gosh. So it's a six-hour trip, several hundred miles. I don't know. It's a long ways.
Right.
It was a six-hour trip there, 6 hours back. They spent the night. There was a pharmacy that they'd been directed by someone. Don't know who. I mean, obviously, this kid already knew where to go. But a pharmacy that was about 32 miles away from her office, she had the other pharmacies in her area had stopped filling her prescriptions. In fact, one of them had reported her to the DEA. That's how a DEA investigation had started 2.5 years before my son even went to see her. She had been under investigation for illegal prescribing. So there was a connection, bottom line, between her business and the pharmacy that was actually shut down about a year ago by the pharmacy board for irregularities that were very obviously linked to her.
So this is a doctor that even the pharmacies around her have stopped filling her prescriptions, mm-hmm. reported this to the DEA. All this information is going on 2 years before Joey walks in the door.
At least.
Where does this information end up?
You know, in the case of Joey's doctor, the DEA was working their case. Ultimately, the medical board came on board. This information isn't really easy to get from any of these agencies, so I don't truly even still know how all of it coalesced and ultimately resulted in her arrest, but that actually happened. So on March 1st last year, 2012, she was arrested and charged with second-degree murder in Joey's case and two other young men, and there are 21 other felony accounts against this doctor that she's been sitting in jail since, waiting for trial to combat. So it's just crazy stuff. Here we are now, a family that was perfectly normal, and we had been very blessed by not having addiction in our family up to that point, except for my dad. My dad had been an alcoholic, but he had stopped drinking when I was 2 years old, so I literally grew up not ever seeing my dad drink. Alcohol was a complete taboo, in fact, in our house because of his history of drinking, so it wasn't something that existed, and Joey himself did not have a history of any abuse that I knew of, you know. Things happen, and certainly as, you know, as we look back, well, what about all those college, you know, he was just a super popular kid and lots of friends, and I imagine there were times when he was off doing things we never learned about and never will now, but there was never any trouble he got into because of this stuff, and here we are, go from a kid that's got great grades. He had been on the dean's list there at ASU, and suddenly he's not coming home because he's overdosed. And it just hit us like an absolute ton of bricks, a truck, whatever, a bus. It was horrible, and it's still horrible. You know, every day we live with this loss and this needless loss. It was such a preventable thing. Had he understood the dangers, I really don't believe he would have been down this path at all. Up to that point, nobody in his circle of life had died. After he died, we saw a string of deaths at ASU, you know, prescription drug-related deaths. There were at least 8 of them that I've counted. That was that first year, and I know of at least 2 or 3 more since. And that's just one university. This happens in every university.
It does. It happens all over the nation, as we know too well. So we know that it was 2 years before Joey was even, you know, any of this was really, that this doctor was basically breaking the law in multiple ways to the point that even the peers of her or pharmacies were not willing to fill prescriptions. How much longer was it before you were sitting in a courtroom and looking at this doctor or going over that?
Oh, a year and a half later. So we're talking about an investigation that had been underway by at least the DEA for at least 3 years before she was arrested. And at that point, it was really clear by then the medical board was involved. I myself had filed a medical board complaint a year before she was arrested and basically hand-fed them all kinds of documentation and information that I had gathered by then to support our case. And by then, we had also sued the doctor, a civil lawsuit against the doctor and the pharmacy, and they didn't even take us to court. They just settled. So bottom line is, like, you know, we're talking 3 years the minimum that she had been, you know, had been under investigation before her arrest. So,
well, when we come back from the break, I want to talk about what you discovered when you got in front of that doctor and how that plays into the cures program or the cures legislation that we talked to Senator DeSaunier on earlier in the show, how they all kind of tied together. We're coming up on a break. I'm Bradley DeHaven. You're listening to Afflicted by Addiction, and we'll be right back.
What's going on behind the scenes with your favorite Voice America show or host? For the latest news, visit the iRadio blog at iradioblog.com.
Bradley DeHaven has spoken to thousands of parents and addicts, discovering commonalities and teachable moments that can spare you the consequences of addiction. The signs, symptoms, and solutions of drug addiction is something you can learn now or when you are forced to. Bradley has written two books on drug addiction from the view of a parent. His no BS approach could save your child's life. Brad has been interviewed on Fox, ABC, CBS, The Huffington Post, and other forms of media. Brad and his son appear in the award-winning documentary Behind the Orange Curtain. Brad's available as a keynote speaker for events and corporations. Learning about addiction is important for every family. All the rules have changed, and now the drugs that addict our children are synthetic heroin, prescribed by your doctor and found in your own medicine cabinet. Sign up for Brad's newsletter on rxdrugaddict.com and find links to his two books, Defining Moments and The Addict Among Us. Again, be sure to visit rxdrugaddict.com for more information.
Hi, I'm Bradley DeHaven, and I'm the host of Afflicted by Addiction. The best rehab is the one that works for you. And this show has been made possible by the generous contribution of the rehab center that my son went to, Narcanon. I'm blessed that my son is 2.5 years clean of the drugs that once owned him. Narcanon gave him the tools that he needed to walk through a world filled with drugs and not return to the darkness of addiction. Narcanon did not want to run a commercial during this program, but I want to thank them for allowing the voice of those of you who are afflicted by addiction to be heard. Visit my website, rxdrugaddict.com, to get a link to Narcanon, and if you want to learn more, just click on the site. Again, the best rehab is the one that works for you. Most importantly, seek professional help if you are afflicted by addiction.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
You are tuned in to Afflicted by Addiction with your host, Bradley DeHaven. If you have a question or comment for Brad about the program, please send an email to brad@rxdrugaddict.com. That's brad@rxdrugaddict.com. Now back to our program, Afflicted by Addiction.
Welcome back to Afflicted by Addiction. I'm your host, Bradley DeHaven. We're here every Tuesday at noon, and we hope that you'll join us. If you miss any of the shows, you can go to rxdrugaddict.com and look for the Afflicted by Addiction link and listen to any of the shows on archive. Please share them with your friends, and please listen to these very important interviews. We were joined earlier by Senator DeSaunier, who has the cures legislation in today, on August the 13th, the cures legislation at the California Capitol. And this is a prescription drug monitoring program for a very short definition of what it is. And we're now joined by April Rivero, who we were just talking about her son who overdosed and died from a lethal prescription that was prescribed to her by a dirty doctor that now sits in a jail cell. Welcome back, April.
Thank you, Brad.
So what I wanted to kind of touch on is the interesting thing here is when you went in and you're sitting in front of this doctor, had you ever heard of the cures?
Yes, I had, because at that point, by then, we had been operating our organization, the National Coalition Against Prescription Drug Abuse,
right,
for about a year and a half. We were incorporated and got running on June 2nd, 2010. So cures came up really early in discussion. In fact, in 2010, I joined Bob Pack and Senator DeSaunier in Sacramento to actually hold a press conference and testify ultimately in the hearing that was going on that day in support of a previous attempt on the senator's part to get funding for the program. So I was really aware of the program, and so I had a true appreciation for its capabilities and what it offered to both law enforcement and medical professionals. But it really was brought home on a really personal level when I was sitting in a courtroom, actually in back of the doctor that is being tried for all these things. She Well, let's see. I was sitting there in the courtroom, and bottom line is the data that the prosecution team brought to the table in terms of testimony by the folks running Cures, you know, a representative from the Cures program actually came to testify, and the data that had been pulled from the system showed the irregularities, the heavy prescribing on the part of this doctor, and individuals who were still alive that had been patients of her were put on the stand to support the prosecution's position, and their testimony was collaborated by the level of prescribing that the Cures program data showed had been done, you know, for them. So it was really easy to see that this data that is being collected every single day, every single time a prescription is filled, the data goes into the database, that data is absolutely gold to prosecution teams who are trying to make a difference out there with this, you know, this war that we're in, this epidemic and war that we're trying to win with prescription drug abuse.
But this is data that could have been used to save your son's life.
Absolutely. I know. And that's a sad thing, because had the doctor who, you know, if she had been a legitimate doctor and she'd looked in the database as he came in the door and he said, oh, gee, I'm taking 80 milligram strength OxyContin. Well, that wasn't true. And so all she'd have to do is look in the system. There was never one single prescription ever written to for Joey for any of those controlled substances, other than, I think, Vicodin when he was, you know, like a senior in high school. One prescription, that was it. He never even got one single pill. We put it away and then ultimately tossed it out. He never even asked for it. So the data's there. And, boy, on both sides of the fence, both the lawmaker, you know, the law prosecution teams, they have an opportunity to proactively use that data to see where the outlying doctors are, who are the heavy prescribers, who do they need to look at least. I've worked with DEA. They do use that data proactively when they can, but the medical board hasn't, which I think is a real crime. The data is there so they can, you know, get a heads up on their doctors. They're supposed to be monitoring, overseeing, supporting, certainly, but they don't use it proactively. It just sits there, and it isn't being proactively used.
It's sad. Do you now know what your son was prescribed on that fateful day?
Oh, I do, certainly. You know, we knew that 4.5 months later, and it took that long to get the coroner's report. They told us exactly what he died from. And we also got a copy of the prescriptions through our attorney as we filed the lawsuits we did. So we know exactly what he was prescribed, 30 milligram strength oxycodone. And, you know, that's a very high dosage for somebody that just walks in your office for the first time and you have no medical history for. He was prescribed Soma and he was prescribed Xanax, you know, the Holy Trinity, as I've heard it's called on the street. So, you know, very commonly that those three types of drugs are very commonly prescribed to people who are drug seeking. So, yeah, Cures is just so immensely important. Of all the legislation that our organization and I have personally engaged in, this is the most important to me. Because
do you think that if Cures is passed, how do you see this helping the Joeys of the world in the future?
Well, how can be helped, as we heard in Senator DeSoni's earlier segment of this program, one of the unfortunate features of the bill that was in there and is no longer there is the mandatory requirement that prescribers use this database. But I do believe that even without that clause in the legislation, it will make a difference, because right now what I hear when I talk to doctors, and every time I see a doctor myself, I ask them about their use of Cures. And what I'm hearing is that it's not easy to get on. It takes too long. It's cumbersome. It's almost impossible to even get on the program, period, right now, because there's an application process, and it's not easy. And because they only have one single employee that oversees the Cures program right now, they can't process the applications to even get these doctors on the program. So once the funding's there, that will go away. It should. I know that it's being renovated, so it should become easier to operate, to access and operate, and I would hope and pray that doctors would use it, that they would be driven to. It protects them, it protects their patients, it protects the practice. Every reason in the world is there for them to use it if they understand those things and they're properly trained in all those things around opioid prescribing and other substances as well that are on the controlled list.
And you've described the Cures system now as basically being on life support, and now you've just described what it would be like when it comes off of life support. So I think therein lies the benefit to all those people out there, is that it's there, but it's not being utilized, used, funded, or anything else. One employee for an agency, I don't even know if there's another agency in the whole state of California that has one employee.
That's ridiculous. Yeah, and I've actually talked personally to that person, and, you know, he's passionate about the program. He understands the benefits of it, but what can he do? He's one person, so.
Exactly.
Anyway,
well,
that will
take, I know we've
though,
got
sure.
just a few minutes left, but one of the things that we want to talk about, Senator DeSantis even mentioned that we need to unite and we need to come together, and there's a big event coming up in Washington, D.C. on October 1st. Tell us what you know, April Rivero, about this show.
I'd love to. Yeah, the Fed Up rally is happening on October 1st, and there are details that are still being put together on it in terms of what our platform is going to look like, but this is an opportunity for people from across the country to come together in a single, on a single day, in a single location, and to let our voices be heard loud and clear. I believe we'll have a big enough mass, and the connections that we have, I think, are outstanding in terms of pulling in celebrities to the issues and on and on. We will have a meaningful a group of people there representing individuals and organizations, agencies, whatever, all across the country. And we're going to be focusing on opioid overprescribing and also the heroin connection. And I know you've talked about that on some of your other programs, Bradley.
Right.
The uptick in heroin usage, of course, now that people can't afford to stay on pills as their tolerance levels grow. So there's going to be a heavy focus on that. But, you know, underlying all of that, our platform is about, you know, overprescribing period of all these different controlled substances. We want to talk about the stigma of addiction. You talked about that with the senator. We want universal, affordable, evidence-based recovery options out there for anybody with trouble, in trouble with any addiction issue, but certainly our focus is on pills. Prescribers need to be trained. We need consumers to be educated that, you know, this one pill for every ill mentality is crazy, and we've got to change that. So those are going to be part of our platform, and there are other things I'm sure that will be discussed as well. But we just encourage everybody to go to fedUpRally.com, and you can basically, you know, go on to the registration site on Eventbrite and register to either be there and let your voice be heard, or otherwise help donate to the cause, because we do need money to put on a very professional rally, and that's what this is going to be.
Absolutely. And we do need to have one booming voice out there. And the Fed Up rally in Washington, D.C. on October 1st is going to be that rally. We hope that you'll be there or that you'll support it. Go to fedUpRally.com, or there's a link on my website at rxdrugaddict.com. Thank you so much, April, for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me again.
You're very welcome. And thank you for introducing me to the senator. And you're listening to Afflicted by Addiction. I'm your host, Bradley DeHaven, and we'll be back next week.
Thank you so much for tuning in this week. Please join Bradley DeHaven for another Afflicted by Addiction program on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll be back next Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time. We'll talk more then.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.